nothing is more expensive than bad information. Know the source. OneRadioNetwork.com.
Well, a very pleasant good morning to you. This is Patrick Timpone. And that music is music to our ears. When we have Fred Deshefsky on, he is the head guy here when we do the real world of money. Fred is a currency historian. He learned a lot from his partner and was on his own in the library when his mom made him go out and play ball, but he went to the library and he learned about the monetary history of these United States, partner with the ever-present Andrew Goss, who is channeling us all the time with the money stuff. Fred is also the head guy at U.S. Coin Capital, U.S. Coin Capital, and we'll tell you that phone number as we move along here this morning, and they buy and sell numismatic coins. So, Freddie, that means you've been in the business for, a long time.
Yeah, it'll be a week on Thursday.
Week Thursday, good. You go to school at night for it? Is that how you learn?
I think we're 36 years now. I've been in the gold and silver coin business.
Is that right? 36 years. Yeah.
Time moves quickly. What can I tell you?
Yeah, just off the top, I've been seeing shortages. Have you seen about shortages of coins in these great United States? And I hear that the mint is having a hard time keeping up with that old hunks of silver, right?
Well, believe it or not, the modern current change that we use has actually become a little bit of an issue. There's no silver content, of course, in any United States coins since 1964. Mm-hmm. So there would seem to be no rational reason why we'd run out of coins that we can produce so quickly and so cheaply. But the reality of the world is that with the coronavirus breakout, a lot of cash transactions have slowed down, and a lot of people have chosen to not handle cash. And in so doing, there has been a lack of transfer of coins. And believe it or not, the Treasury actually hit a point where it was struggling to meet demand for just current change within the businesses that use them readily. First time in my career we've ever experienced anything kind of quite like that. That was a little unusual.
Many people conjecture that this corona thing is part of a bigger picture of people wanting to disco cash, get moved more to a...
Sorry about that.
Yeah. Can you hang that thing up? Okay. many people conjecture that this corona thing is part and parcel of getting more to a digital currency. Can you answer that phone or do something?
Yes, got that. Sorry.
That's right. What do you think? You think possible?
Well, the Federal Reserve has been looking at digital currency. Some people have asked whether they've been delving into investigating cryptos. I haven't seen any evidence of cryptocurrency investigations by the Fed, but digital currency has certainly been a subject that has come up, and the Fed has been exploring the idea. I've talked to a few people about this. Technology has a way of moving forward whether we want it to or not. So, eventually it seems to me that the likelihood that there might be a digital dollar in the future, you can never say never. So it's certainly a possibility. And I think the Fed has considered what that would look like. I think the broad picture about a digital currency, though, for the real world term, it doesn't really change anything except the way the dollar would appear.
Right.
And the ability, of course, to track it. Now, for those people who are, suggesting that the big concern about digital currency is that we lose our financial privacy, you can't conduct private commerce if everything digital is tracked, and that is certainly the case. So there's an issue to be drawn there. Other than that, if the dollar were to switch to digital as opposed to the printed paper note that we're familiar with in the world today, I don't really see an awful lot changing, except the ability to increase the supply would become a lot more facilitated because it would only require punching a couple of keys on a keyboard as opposed to the process now, which is Congress authorizing the issue of the money, the Treasury Department then having the money created, and then the Federal Reserve using its reserve capital to buy the capital and then loan it back to Congress and then filter it through the economy. So we could save a few steps in the process. But I do have a concern about digital money because, as silly as it may sound, we can still count dollars. You know, we can count physical paper money. I don't know how we would ever be able to logistically keep track of how much money is in the economy if it's all digital. We would just simply have to trust, you know, if we're looking at the H4-1 release by the Federal Reserve, that those numbers are accurate. There would be, you know, no counter way to actually make sure that the numbers were correct.
Yes. So, but it's a fair statement, though, Fred Dyshevsky, that out of about 25 trillion in circulation, only a trillion and a half or so is paper now. So can we say that, you know, most of it, 96 or 7%, is already digital? You're just talking about moving to a blockchain?
Not necessarily blockchain, but yes, to a form of digital currency. And you're right. Most of the money that is floating around now is already in some digital form, and the amount of it that's in cash is, you know, smaller and smaller all the time.
Right. So that, I guess, the argument of the people that say they want to get rid of the $2 trillion and go ahead and just do it all, you know, all digital on computers, and then that would move more to a whatever cashless society, which people have talked about, and Andrew, of course, you guys had talked about for a long time.
Very long time. Yeah, we looked at the advent of a cashless society decades ago, and that was before the technology existed to be able to do it.
Right,
so,
right.
You know, the technology has now caught up to the world, and now it's actually a legitimate possibility. You know, the physical infrastructure to create a digital currency certainly does exist now, where it really didn't 30 years ago. So we could see it as a likely possibility now a lot more simply because the technology has come of age.
Yeah. I was reading an article the other day, and I'm trying to find it here, but there is a bill in Congress, or in the Senate, actually. It's only been proposed. I don't think it's been taken to the floor, Fred, where it could be a real hit on cryptocurrencies from a privacy kind of a thing. It was kind of a spooky article, so we'll have to follow that. Have you heard anything about that?
Well, I think the issue with the cryptocurrencies is going to come down to, you know, I refer to the poking of the bear. So if we continue to push cryptocurrencies and any of them start to really take a significant hold, which I think we're a very, very long away from, if it starts to become such an issue that it really is a competing currency in any sense whatsoever to the Federal Reserve dollar and the central banks that control the paper world and the current currency world don't have control over these cryptos, what they will do is simply put them under their umbrella. I am sure that they will federally regulate any cryptocurrency that becomes so popular that it starts getting usage to an extent where it begins to impact the number of dollars that are being spent. And then once it becomes regulated, I think it loses a lot of its appeal, because for most people, I think the benefit of a cryptocurrency is the financial privacy aspect. And, you know, regardless of the fact that, you know, we could argue whether right now a lot of crypto transactions are used by criminals, that is not 100% the case. There are a lot of legitimate people and businesses trying to use it.
Sure.
It's not fluid at the moment. It's not easy to do. You can't really walk into a supermarket at this point and, you know, use Bitcoin to buy a loaf of bread. But I do believe that if any of these cryptos ever, you know, began to kind of grab any sort of hold in terms of volume within the world's transactions, it would simply become regulated. They'll absolutely throw it under their umbrella. And then once it's regulated, again, I think most of the appeal for it as an alternative is going to fade away.
Fred Dyshevsky is here if you care to join us. Patrick at OneRadioNetwork.com. Well, it's also interesting to think about, Fred, the idea that with more and more retail places going belly up, you know, the Sears and all the stores that are closing with the Corona thing, and they may never come back, that then more and more things online, of course, that gets rid of cash too.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You know, there's a reduction in the amount of It doesn't reduce the amount of cash in the system.
No, but I mean cash, yeah. Paper. But yeah.
You know, the flow will slow down for sure. And, you know, look, this is a strange economy. I do want to point out it is vastly different than the crisis in 2008 and 2009 in one very, very large respect, and that is the 08 and 09 crisis was a liquidity crisis. It was a lack of access to capital. That was a real fundamental problem we are not experiencing right now. The Federal Reserve has gone to extensive, unprecedented efforts to make sure that there was plenty of money in this current economic environment to prevent it from becoming a fiscal crisis of liquidity. And the extreme methods that they've chosen to try to prevent this from becoming a crisis are unfortunately something we are, as Americans, going to be paying for a very, very long time to come after this crisis comes and goes.
Yeah. Speaking of coming and going, Fred, we follow this pretty closely, of course, you know, the cases and all that. And the general belief out there in the government and states and, governments, mayors and governors, and is that more and more people should get tested. So there's a big push to test people. And because they're testing more people are coming up positive. And the people in the state legislatures and offices believe that if you test positive, then you are a case, right? That's their belief. So they're going with that. And in places like Florida and Texas, and now even going into New Jersey and New York, I think you have to have in quarantine for 2 weeks when you travel from Texas and Florida because it's got more quote-unquote cases. So it looks like if you really, well, we know, so then we can assume that this corona thing, just by the way it's being done out there, right or wrong or indifferent, whether or not you agree with the model, is going to go on through the election. I mean, it really looks like it.
I wouldn't be surprised. You know, I have made it clear I have absolutely no medical knowledge.
Right. Right.
So
that's all right.
My opinion about, you know, how this virus will work its way through, you know, is useless. I can only base my opinions on other information coming from more viable resources when it comes to that. But this doesn't look like it's something that's going to disappear quickly.
It doesn't.
I'm looking at it from a point of view of the money end.
Right.
Only because I could tell you flat out that if it were to completely end tomorrow, and, for, you know, not that that's physically possible, but if suddenly, you know, they have a solution and the whole thing comes to a screeching halt tomorrow, it's no longer an issue.
Mm-hmm.
We are still going to be paying for decades for what we've already done to try to make sure that we have the liquidity necessary. You know, the Fed has instituted its emergency policies to a level that has never been seen before. And the amount of money that it's created, the trillions and trillions of dollars that they pumped into the economy, can't be unwound quickly. The Fed experimented on trying to reduce its balance sheet a year ago, and it was a horrible, horrible result as it tried to bring down the balance sheet from the crisis from 2008. And it was carrying that debt and then began to try to unwind it, and it caused huge financial upsets. So, and that was with $4 trillion. Now we're $7.5 trillion to date into this, and I still believe we're going to be close to $10 trillion when all is said and done. So even if the crisis in the health side of this
would end tomorrow, like you say,
resolved,
yeah, wow.
Even if that's resolved quickly, we still are not going to be able to walk away from the efforts that the Fed has made to move the economy forward for a very long time to come once this is all said and done.
Well, we can unpack that. Fred Deshefsky, Patrick Timpone, The Real World of Money, brought to you by U.S. Coin Capital. Their number is 800-878-2646. And Fred's going to tell you here in a few minutes why he believes that maybe it just might be a good idea to own some gold and silver coins with what's going on. So I think we can conjecture right now, or not just not conjecture, Fred, but look, Fred's balance sheet as of June 24, you're talking $4 trillion so far since the end of December, right? $4 trillion that's on the balance sheet, on the Fed's balance sheet, which means that was, correct me if I'm wrong, it was created by the Fed digitally, and then they purchased notes from the Treasury, correct?
The Fed has been doing an awful lot of things, not only purchasing notes from the Treasury, but it has also extended its operations to include a lot more new and unusual kind of processes to add to the pumping of liquidity.
And what are some of those things there? So what Fred's talking about is, I understand, is they're monetizing paper that they want to, what would the word be, Fred? They're monetizing paper that they would want to, what would the word be? To take care of, to take it under their umbrella?
Well, what they're doing is, I would say they're providing liquidity.
Providing liquidity.
If the Federal Reserve goes out and buys a huge supply of U.S. Treasuries, mm-hmm. then it can provide direct liquidity into the economy. Mm-hmm. If, however, that isn't sufficient, it has other operations it can use. So, for example, it instituted what it called quantitative easing, which was a direct purchase of the long end of the maturity bond side. In order to keep interest rates low, it would buy very heavily on the long end of the issues of the Treasury debt. That wasn't sufficient. So then it went to...
Okay, let me stop you there. Let's understand that. So let's see. The Fed would buy 30-year Treasuries that they would issue, say, a billion in a Treasury note for 30 years. And what does that do to interest rates by buying the long end?
Well, it leaves only the short end of the maturity scale available to purchase if it's buying up all of the long end of the market. So it's absorbing all the long end debt, and then it affords the ability for rates to remain low because what we have left are the short end of the scale. So it's a kind of a direct intervention by the Federal Reserve to artificially keep interest rates low, as opposed to directly lowering interest rates itself through its normal mechanism.
Oh, because it was already very low. It was already at what, a quarter point, right?
Sure. And the problem is the Fed has almost no room left to lower rates any further through its normal mechanism.
Yes,
so it has had to come up with creative processes, which it's only supposed to do in the worst emergencies. It's this 13.3, well, not to get too technical, but it's the section of the Federal Reserve Act that allows it to operate differently under emergency circumstances, to extend credit to non-bank financial firms. And it hasn't done that since the 1930s.
Wow. But so there's a section in the Federal Reserve Act, which is running the thing right now from 1913, that says if you really get into a jam, you guys can be a whole lot more creative with the amount of things that you create money and buy.
And how you do it.
And
so,
how you
for
do
example,
it.
In 2008, you know, it exclusively tailored money for the what they called the too big to fail firms. So mm-hmm, that included mm-hmm. AIG and Bear Stearns and Bank of America and Citigroup.
Right.
You know, and they got special treatment from the Fed, which normally would not have been authorized or legal under the Fed's charter, but became so because the Fed said, okay, we are declaring a state of emergency. And it's kind of like, a good analogy would be like martial law. So there are certain things that cannot be done in the United States unless the president declares martial law. Once you declare martial law, you now have a whole new set of rules that you can apply. And the Fed has taken that same premise and said, okay, we are instituting 13.3. We are claiming an emergency. And we're claiming an emergency, and we are going to start to institute policies that, you know, maybe objectionable, maybe questionable, but we're going to do it because this has become necessary. And they're very concerned about the onslaught of what they're doing and how they're going to eventually have to unwind it. They don't have a plan to unwind it. A lot of people believe they'll never be able to unwind it. They functionally won't be able to do it. There's no mechanism for them to be able to do it. But they are putting that concern on the back burner in lieu of making sure that today we don't have a liquidity crisis.
Okay, so let's two things we want to look at. What does it matter? Unwind would mean to sell off the whatever this ends up with, Fred, say the $8 or $9 or $10 trillion on their balance sheet that they created. And then why do they have to unwind that? Give us tell us, like, we're a young child or a golden retriever, why can't they just leave it up there? Because who cares? They created the money and they've got the paper and everybody's happy.
Well, the problem is that the Federal Reserve balance sheet is sort of, you have to look at it like an equilibrium. Mm-hmm. But the heavier weighted the federal balance sheet is, the less ability it has to work within the normal markets. So if it is crowding out the credit world by taking all of the debts and putting it on its own balance sheet, it creates kind of an unwieldy market. And there has been a traditional relationship between the equilibrium between, for example, gold prices and what's on the Fed's balance sheet. The higher the Fed's balance sheet grows, the more we tend to see gold prices increase. Because in the end, the Fed is required to zero out its balance sheet. Whoa. You know, it can't continue to acquire all of the bad debt from all of the bad resources and simply, you know, bury it in the basement and forget about it.
How often do they have to zero it out, Fred?
Well, it's not a matter of time per se. It's a matter of, again, it's a balance of equilibrium. So if the balance sheet is relatively small compared to the size of the GDP, mm-hmm. they can carry that debt for quite some time. But when the size of the balance sheet begins to get too large relative to the GDP, it becomes a bit unwieldy and it raises concerns that they may never be able to unwind it. And if so, it creates a suspicion that the Fed and its policies are not going to be able to be sustainable, that at some point it's going to create a crack in the economy and it's going to create a loss of confidence in the overall economic environment of the United States and the U.S. dollar as a whole around the world.
Interesting. So it's a confidence game again with that. Fred Deshefsky, one thing before we talk about some coins and what would be a good thing for people to start with. But so I want to go back to the idea of buying long term to keep interest rates down. If you buy, let's see if I understand, if the Fed goes in and buys more of the long term debt from Treasury and from other people, doesn't that make the shorter term debt more, what would it make it? Why would it keep it down? I don't understand that. Why would it keep short-term rates down by buying the long stuff? I'm missing something. Hello?
Sorry. Okay. You there?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
A little technical problem there. So the longer term tends to pay a higher yield.
Okay.
So it's going to attract the money that's going to go into the market, lock it up for 20 or 30 years, and pay a higher rate of return. Now, if you want to try to lower interest rates, you can take out that option. So you can drive the invested capital into the shorter term loans and keep the rates that they pay lower so that the overall debt is less because you're paying out less in interest payments on the same amount of money. If you allow the money to drift into the higher end of the yield curve, even though it's locked up for a longer period of time, you're also paying a higher interest rate.
Gotcha.
So if you want to manipulate the market, you can simply eliminate the opportunity for somebody to have the choice. If the Fed buys up all of the long-term part of the yield curve, what's left is the shorter stuff that pays lower interest rates.
Very interesting. So it's a way to eat up the stuff that's paying more, so people have to just buy if they want to go into treasuries, which I guess people still to this day, Fred, do they believe the treasuries are a very safe bet?
Well, safe is a relative term, and I don't mean to be sarcastic about that, but when we look at safe, what we're comparing it to is the question. So safe compared to what? Safe compared to the stock market? Absolutely, and that is the issue. So if you are a investor or a money manager, a hedge fund person, you have money, and your choice is, well, I can go into the stock market, which is extremely volatile, and potentially lose money for my customers, or I can get a fixed guaranteed rate of return. As low as it may be, that is at least a guarantee that I will not lose principal, except for inflation, which, you know, is a separate issue. And we know that at least that is a stable environment. So if there's fear of volatility in, let's say, the stock market or the traditional investments, then yes, a treasury security would appear to be a secure and safe alternative.
Mm-hmm. Fred Jasewski,
in the real world, go ahead. I have a problem.
Sorry, go ahead. No, go, and I'm sorry, I cut you off.
I was just going to say, in the real world, I have a problem with that, because if you buy into the premise, the idea is that you are expecting that you've bought that treasury and it's going to yield you, you know, you buy a 10-year note, it pays 0.67%. So you're locked up for 10 years, you get your 0.67%. You have to presume inflation would not exceed that interest rate for you to really end up gaining any kind of profit at the end of the line. I don't believe that that is possible.
Yeah, right. So let's talk about that a second. So if you get, what is it, 30-year pay, 3%, 2.5%?
No, not even. Not even.
I'm sorry?
They're in the 2%. Yeah, they're in the 2% range.
2%. Wow. For 30 years, we had, you know, John Williams of ShadowStats.com, right? John has been at it about 40 years, and he goes to source material. He said yesterday on the show that real inflation is running around about 10% today.
Okay. Well, there's a number of ways to define inflation. If you simply look at the expansion of the money supply versus the expansion of goods and services, anytime more money is chasing fewer goods, you have inflation. The money supply has expanded by 25% since the corona crisis broke out. If you annualize it, it's about 102% a year that we've increased in the money supply. Mm-hmm. We are getting to a point right now where deficits are going to average $2 trillion a year. $2 trillion a year. That'll be an average figure. By 2030, we're going to be at $40.9 trillion in debt, or 135% of the gross domestic product of the country.
And as you know, GDP is really bombing. He says that there's going to be some GDP numbers for quarter three that you're not going to even believe that are possible, John Williams. I mean, what's his name? Whatever. Williams. Huh. Wow.
So what happens if every dollar that the country creates and every resource, all the manufacturing, everything combined, the GDP of the entire nation is less than what the national debt is? That means that we're effectively at a point where there's no mathematical way to ever pay it off.
Well, we're there now, aren't we, Fred? Excuse me. I mean, we're there now, right? What's the GDP? Last time we checked, wasn't it $17
trillion? Yes.
Well, we're at 26 bonded debt today.
Right. So what happens if it gets to a point where the national debt is so much more than the GDP that progressively we start to diverge farther and farther to a point where it becomes not only unsustainable, but unrealistic to expect it could ever be paid off. And here's another monkey wrench that works. What happens if what's on the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve's balance sheet, what happens if the debt they're carrying, what happens if any of that implodes? You know, then what happens? What happens if we have, you know, like we had with, you know, real estate investments? What happens if any of these things don't unwind and they completely implode? We've got a huge, massive hole problem. And again, I see the only possible way for us moving forward over the next decade is the creation of a massive amount of new money. That is the only solution left on the table. The Fed has used every trick in its magic bag. It's borrowed somebody else's magic bag, used up all their tricks, and now it's just making stuff up off the top of its head as fast as it can come up with ideas. But the American public is going to feel the impact of this, because there is nothing that can sustain the amount of debt that we are creating. And if we keep choosing to ignore the reality, that is, you cannot print your way out of every economic problem, because you also act like Jim Grant made an analogy, it's like a drug dealer. You know, the economy becomes addicted to these artificial low interest rates,
right,
and the pumping of money into the system.
Right. So that's why so many people, I mean, more than ever, are really long gold, right? Believing that gold is going to go up considerably, and silver, in the years to come.
Absolutely.
How does that help or work with people buying numismatics? I mean, wouldn't they be better just to go out and buy an ounce of a hunk of gold, put it under their bed rather than spend extra for a collectible coin, where a lot of the value is in the collectability of it and the rarity of it. What's the advantage of your business then?
Well, the advantage is simply two things. One huge one, which is the difference in available supply. So first of all, numismatic coins, even those that carry very little premium over their metal content, are an item that there are only a limited number of in existence. No more can be mined. You know, there is no new resource to print more of them or make more of them to meet any additional demand. You can't accelerate the rate of availability if we increase the available numbers of paper dollars in the economy. So what you have is a dynamic there that forces the prices and premiums for those coins more quickly than movement in just merely the value of the metal of gold or silver, for example, itself. The other thing I look at is that, you know, numismatic coins, any American silver or gold United States coin, this is the money of our country. These are the actual dollars created under the United States Constitution, issued directly to the public for the purpose of providing protection of wealth to an average investor over time. It was designed to prevent economic problems or politicians or any kind of unforeseen events from deteriorating the value of the wealth or the work that people put in to accumulate their money. Because unlike the Federal Reserve, we don't have a fictitious checkbook to create digits or dollars to pump into another checking account to subsequently be able to write checks to pay off all our bills when we run out of money. We as Americans have to work. We have to put labor out there, put out effort, and or invest in order to achieve a growth in the number of dollars that we have. And if those dollars are going to be affected by an outside force, there has to be a protection method. And that was the whole concept of the American gold and silver coins. The other thing that I think is important is that the bullion market itself is a regulated industry. And most of the transactions, except for when central banks make large physical acquisitions, most bullion transactions don't actually occur in the physical world. You know, 80% of it is in paper. It's all contracts, it's options and futures. Mm-hmm. And that means that you're going to get a lot of volatility. You're going to get swings in prices that can come out of nowhere. Perfect example of that was in 2011, when silver and gold prices ran up very, very quickly for a very brief period of time and then came right back down because of some options and futures tradings. You don't get that in a physical numismatic coin, because you cannot leverage your purchase. If you want to buy a $20 American gold coin, there's only one way to do it. You put down the money and you take possession of the coin. That's it. There's no option contract to leverage its purchase in the future at some fixed price for a tenth of the money. You have to buy it outright. And because the supplies are fixed and it's an unregulated market, and it is the U.S. currency, it is the better choice by far than bullion.
Excellent. So that's the selling point. That's the, how you build your business on that, on those ideas.
Yeah, and there are a lot of American gold and silver coins that carry very little premium over their metal content. There are what we refer to in the industry as the semi-numismatics. You know, they have a couple hundred bucks more than their melt content and value. You know, when they're made of an ounce of gold that itself is $1,760 an ounce, similar premiums to what you pay to buy any form of refined gold in the world today. So, you know, that difference is negligible in some instances, to the point where it's not a price issue. And again, anytime you can own something where there's a fixed supply that can never change, that is a huge asset to somebody who has possession. Because, you know, as you've mentioned, there have been periodic shortages of availability.
Fred Duszewski, Patrick Timpone, OneRadioNetwork.com. So this thing is kind of curious. I don't understand what it is, but it doesn't sound like it's opposite of anything that you were talking about. But there's a new thing that's been released 2 days ago. And they, are you still there?
Yes.
Oh, I heard some kind of whoop like that. Okay. I thought the Skype thing is making noise. It is a way to buy corporate stuff, corporate debt. And this is called, let me see if I can find the thing. I lost it. Do you know what I'm talking about? It began 2 days ago.
You're talking about the Federal Reserve buying the corporate debt?
Correctamundo.
Yes, yes. They are including that among several other options of new investment areas to attack, because unfortunately what they found is choice number one, which is the simple, normal process of the Federal Reserve to add liquidity, simply buying treasuries, mm-hmm. was not sufficient. Choice number two, add quantitative easing so that you can drive interest rates down, add liquidity without having to create additional money, that wasn't sufficient. So now we're up to choice number three, which is to try to provide additional liquidity into various parts of the economy that normally the Fed would never even look at. And that includes the buying of mortgage-backed securities, ETFs, municipal debt, and debt of corporations
yes.
that may already be in debt. And I think this creates a bit of a problem because if, for example, the value of the stock of a company is based upon its balance sheet, and its balance sheet is positive because the Fed is giving it money, buying its stock right out from the open market, that is not being supported by a broad group of investors who believe fundamentally in the company and its value. It's an artificial market being created by the Federal Reserve, and that means the pumping up of the stock price is also artificial. And when the Fed does this, it creates bubbles. And the problem with bubbles is they burst. Hmm.
So, but they bought, Fred, they bought mortgage-backed securities and other things in 2008. So did they have to declare some kind of emergency to do that? Or is that in their bailiwick charter to do it because they say, Houston, we have a problem?
Oh, yeah, no, they created the Troubled Asset Relief Fund. Yeah, they okay. absolutely declared an emergency in 2008. It was an emergency. That was when they went to Congress and said, we are in such a dire strait of emergency that if you don't give us $950 billion tomorrow,
we're dead, right.
The entire U.S. economy is going to implode. So here's your choice. You just blanketly give us this money without any idea of how we're going to spend it or what we're going to do with it. Trust us that we're going to do this in order to benefit everybody, or, you know, we'll all step back and everything will simply implode and we'll all walk away having destroyed the economy of the U.S. and subsequently, you know, probably devastate the world's economic environment.
Wow.
So, yes, that was absolutely a declaration of emergency. The current state is, again, even larger than what they did in 2008. It's far more substantial in terms of volume. We spent more in 3 months since COVID than we did in 5 years after the 2008 crisis.
Wow.
Yeah, the numbers are extraordinary. I mean, they've leapfrogged. As I've said before, I remember the days in the 80s when we used to raise our eyebrows when $100 million went through the economy. And then by the 90s, it had to be a billion or so before anybody would pay attention. And now we throw trillions around with some, you know, pretending of an idea of how large these numbers are and how long numbers like this will take to unwind. We've substantially increased the rate at which we are putting money into the economy to stave off this problem. And I believe every subsequent economic problem, if we will call them, from here forward, is going to be equally larger than its predecessor.
So it sounds like there's just going to simply be the dance between how much awareness is of how much money is being created, how that's affecting the stock market, and as other people, that it's really all they, whoever they are, can do, right, is just create more money, as you said 30 minutes ago. That's pretty much a given. Is there any way you're going to be wrong on that?
I'm not sure if I understand the question.
Now, is there any way that you would be wrong about the idea that they can do something else to keep this thing going other than create more dollars at the Fed and put them into circulation?
Oh, I don't think there's any other choice.
No choice.
If there were, the Fed would have instituted it by now. I mean, look at what extraordinary circumstances they've already applied to try to solve the current problem. I mean, they've gone into doing things that were really unheard of for a central bank until recent years or even recent months. They've explored opportunities to try to add liquidity into areas that, you know, would not have been authorized under a Fed charter before now. So I think they've used up the magic bag of tricks. And, you know, they've come up with things I would never have thought of. So they are quite creative in this. But in the end, you know, there's really only a limited number of ways to provide liquidity. And whatever they want to call it, we're pumping trillions of dollars into an economy with an unbacked dollar. We're flooding the streets with money. And those people that are sitting at home and saying, okay, well, I have savings and I have earnings that I have, they need to consider what that dollar that they're holding is going to look like in 5 or 10 years after all this money that we've printed filters through the economy. It's going to change what people will be able to buy with those current dollars dramatically that if people don't protect their wealth now, they're going to experience the problem down the road.
So I found the tab that I had, Freddie. It was the Primary Market Corporate Credit Facility. Don't you love these names? PMCCF, which started on Monday, and which kind of just says that, well, if you have a problem with your corporate bonds or your corporate stuff, that we'll trade you. You know, we'll create some dollars and trade you liquidity. So who makes that decision, in your opinion? Is that a Powell thing that says they can do that, or can the New York Fed come up with that, owned by private bankers, come up with that on their own?
I think the Fed chairman will go to Congress and say, here's my plan. I will institute this policy in order to provide this liquidity in this fashion, and I deem this necessary, and suggest that under the 1313 Act of the Federal Reserve Act, it is legal for us to do that. And I need your nod of approval. So, you know, please nod. Please nod.
Has he gone to Congress for these things? I haven't seen, I think, very often. He was there, yesterday with Mnuchin, given the deal. These kind of visits, that's where they say that? Or talk to him? Or?
These things happen behind the scenes more.
Okay.
Visits that you see from Powell, those are testimonies before Congress where they're kind of laying out what they've already done.
Okay.
So they make the decisions behind the curtain, then they come back to the front of the stage and say, okay, you know, we sat in a back room and all the smoke is cleared and this is what we're going to do. And, you know, we kind of need you to just go, yeah, that's okay.
Okay. That would be with who would make those decisions behind closed doors? The Senate Banking Committee people?
It would really be the Federal Reserve.
Who does he go to in Congress behind the scenes, in your opinion?
Well, they're not really going to go to Congress until they've already decided what they want to do. You know, and then they're simply going to go to the Senate authority, the banking committees, and say, okay, you know, again, we need your, let's call it tacit authority, to go ahead with the following program. But it's sort of a given because, you know, if you've ever listened to testimony of Chairman Powell or any of the Fed chairmen before the congressional committees, you kind of get the sense that there's maybe one out of every, you know, maybe 100 who have any sense of what's actually happening. Most of them just simply are kowtowing, you know, oh, thank you, Chairman Powell. You're doing such a great job. Oh, we're so happy to have you. And, oh, thank goodness you're here to help us. And, you know, I don't think very many of them are really taking a hard look at what the Fed is doing. Every once in a while, you know, you get somebody who raises an eyebrow and says, well, wait a minute. You know, does the emperor actually have clothes? Are we debating the purple or the blue when he's naked? And they question the legitimacy of what the Fed's actions are, but it doesn't really go anywhere.
Yeah.
So, yeah, decisions made behind the scenes by the Federal Reserve basically are then brought to Congress, and the required authority comes from the Senate Banking Committees.
So then is it fair to conjecture that President Trump is okay with all this QE and stuff because his job, he wants to get reelected, and the more liquidity and the more things that look better is good for him?
I think it's a choice of that, or what would the opposite choice be? So let's say, for example, the Fed had not instituted quantitative easing after 2008. What if the Fed had not bailed out the economy in 2008? What if they didn't do what they've done since March of this year when COVID broke out, and buy all those treasury securities and buy all that municipal debt and pump all that money into the economy if they had not added the trillions, if Congress hadn't passed the COVID Act and sent the checks out to all the Americans and spent all the money they had, where would we be? We would have had an economy that not only would have come to a screeching halt because of closing businesses, but we would have had a real liquidity problem. And that would have made this 10 times worse than it currently is. This is why I think this is not as significant a financial crisis as 2008 was. I know that's strange to say, because this is being felt by more Americans more directly. But in the overall picture, 2008 was a far worse problem, because that liquidity crunch would have brought down the entire house of cards. The Fed has gone to extreme measures to prevent that from happening in this case. But again, let me just put this out there. For people that are trying to get their head wrapped around all this, the most important thing to remember is, by printing our way out of the problem, we've created a monster. We've created an economy now that, like a drug, is going to demand more and more of this cheap money for a very long period of time. And it's going to create a problem for people trying to store dollars for the next 5 or 10 years if they're not diversified into something physical. This is why I believe that people should take advantage of the ability of Americans to still take ownership of American gold and silver coins, and at least have a portion of one's wealth in that physical form, so that you're not banking everything you've ever earned or saved in your entire life on a paper dollar that is subject to change by forces you cannot control.
Fred Duchesky, uscoincapital.com. So I take it you're just not being Nostradamus with being long gold long term. So that would, right? I mean, it's pretty interesting, right? And you're in a pretty interesting place in your career and in your life working with gold, aren't you? I mean, you'd have to be more sure than ever that gold and silver prices are going to be up a year from now, or
yeah,
2 years, right? I mean,
they are making my job easier.
Oh, I tell you, I mean, it's just, when you really look at the nitty gritty, right? It's just like, whoa. You know, yesterday, yeah, Fred, go ahead.
It's becoming clearer and clearer that, you know, there are very limited possibilities that remain. I do expect some volatility to continue, again, remembering that a lot of the gold itself, if you follow it, the spot price, for example,
right,
you'll see it bouncing around here and there, because there are going to be days where, let's say, there will be some positive news that comes out, something about the stock market that's positive, or, you know, maybe the slowdown of the coronavirus, gets good news play, mm-hmm, and suddenly the stock market revives for a few days, and the gold price retracts a little. There will be some of those days. But the trend for gold is clearly moving higher. I mean, just, it wasn't that long ago, it was less than 2 years ago, we were looking at $1,200 as the range for gold. And then we cracked into that $1,500 barrier. Now we're in the $1,700 to $1,800 range. And I don't see us reverting back. I think we'll just continue to ratchet forward. I think $1,900 gold is around the corner. And I think the subsequent new range for gold within a year, year and a half or so, is going to be in the $2,000 range.
Yeah. Boy, that sure feels even conservative to me. But being in the business, you're better off being conservative, right? Rather than...
Well, I recognize the possibility of pushing down on gold by using options and futures contracts to heavily weight down the growth to try to prevent it from running amok. And actually, I think it's better for everyone if gold moves up slowly and steadily over a longer period of time than if it, for example, were to, you know, double tomorrow, which would be wonderful for all of our customers and for my business, but really not conducive for the overall economy. And it would send a horrible, horrible signal to the world that we've lost control over, you know, anything in the form of the dollar if gold were to double in price overnight. So I actually think it's beneficial that it does retract once in a while. It gives an opportunity for people to buy in at a slightly lower price, average in, and that when it creeps up and moves up slowly over time, it's a better environment overall. But I can't see any other outlook than to expect that the prices for especially numismatic coins are going to have to become higher than they are, both because there's a growing demand, which we haven't even talked about. The increase in demand has been massive around the United States. And we have an environment that is forcing the dollar down in value because we're printing and printing and printing. So you've got a lot of variables that are kind of working together to form a perfect storm, if you will.
So we had John Williams on, as I mentioned yesterday, and he's got his whole numbers think in terms of the money supply right at $25 trillion. I've always thought it was more than that with talking with Andy over the years, but you suppose that's accurate? I mean, I don't know how much more accurate you can get this guy. He just, all he does is geek it out, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I think that's, you know, again, it depends on what you're counting. Mm-hmm. And there are a few, you know, variables there. Some people would count X and Y and not Z, that sort of thing. That's why they used to split the money supply into that, if you remember the old days of the M1, M2, and M3, you know, so they had the liquidity of M1, which was cash and checking accounts, anything that was immediately liquid. And there was the M2, which was the middle term stuff, like something you could turn into money and within a week or so. And then there was the long term stuff, like a 30-year bond that you theoretically couldn't liquidate for longer periods of time. You add all that together, you add up all the money that the Fed is printing, and then, like, you know, how do you count you know, the actions of the Federal Reserve in terms of how much money is that in the total system? So there are a couple of different ways to do the math, which is why you may come up with different numbers. But I you know, I'd accept the idea between $25 and $30 trillion as the, yeah, as the number that's floating around out there. Sounds about right to me.
Yeah, you think it'd be more, but I guess not. Fred Duszewski, OneRadioNetwork.com, the real world of money. So there's no reason. Is there any reason to believe that something like pension funds, Fred, or all the states that are in trouble, or student loans, or whatever, they start to go, you know, belly up, that the Fed wouldn't step in and buy these guys as well?
Well, that is, again, would be a rather unusual step for the Federal Reserve. Traditionally, again, unless we're in a 13-13 situation where they're saying it's an emergency, the Fed doesn't have authority to buy things like municipal debt. So it can't. But if it's going to suggest that, okay, we're in this state of emergency and we don't want a municipality to go under, and we're going to start providing liquidity across the board to that type of entity as well. I see the case where the Fed would make the argument that the overall impact of something like that going south would be so devastating that they want to do preventative maintenance and come in there and support it. I think that's dangerous. I think it's very dangerous. If you're not allowing a free market to unwind when it should, if something goes wrong, you know, if you buy a stock and it goes down, and, you know, you take the loss. If you're a company and you're not making money, you shouldn't be able to continue to borrow indefinitely if you have no assets left. At some point, you have to accept the fact your business model isn't working. So why would your stock price continue to go up artificially? Makes no sense to me. And if you continue to do this, again, you create bubbles. And as I mentioned before, bubbles burst. The problem, as I see it, is that the more the Fed intervenes in more and more of these newer areas, the more it is creating more artificial profit or balances where they shouldn't exist. We need to deal with more reality. And this has been my fundamental problem from the beginning, is that when we can create unbacked money, it's a false market. We're cheating. We're cheating the market. And the ones that feel the impact, it's not the government. It's not the Federal Reserve. It's not the banks. It's the public that has somehow become convinced that it's smart to store a paper dollar over a period of time. That is just insane to my mind.
Yes, sir. I wonder why, though. I mean, what you're talking about here is not, if I can use the old worn-out term, rocket science. If you look at the numbers and understand how the system works, why there's not more people piling into gold and really driving this price up. Is it because it's massively controlled?
No, well, I think it's a lack of knowledge and understanding, and it's not anybody's fault if you think about it. I mean, how many people are going to spend enough time dedicated to kind of unravel this whole web of crap in the economy to kind of get a grasp on what's going on? You know, you say the words Federal Reserve Bank, you pretty much have lost a slew of people right off the top. And again, it's, you know, it's that inside baseball stuff. It's geeky, as you like to put it.
Right.
And that's fine. But, you know, it means that a lot of people will not have the time, you know, or desire to kind of dig into this
stuff.
People are focused upon their career and their families and their lives and their health and their well-being, you know, to the point where it's kind of hard for people to sort of stay on top of this sort of stuff.
Yeah, but I was thinking more in terms of the big money, like the hedge funds and banks and that. I mean, they have the time. This is their business, looking at money and how to make it, that they would be piling more into gold.
Oh, well, they do.
Do they?
They do a lot. In fact, if you think about it, they were the ones who drove the price of gold in 2011 up to where it is now.
Okay.
That's $1,800 level from $1,200. Because they saw an opportunity there, but they tend to be, I guess the best way to look at it is short-term minded.
More day traders.
Profit today and tomorrow. They're not thinking 5 and 10 years out.
Gotcha.
That's not their concern.
So they're more day traders, these people.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so they don't care. They say, we can always have time to buy more gold if we need it. And I guess they can, really. If they really see it piling up, they can just, you know, put in $1 billion that they got in the bank or whatever, right? Just buy.
But I know for a fact that there are a new slew of billionaires who have chosen to take physical possession of large quantities of American gold and silver coins.
Really?
And just put it away, building themselves vault rooms to store it. I mean, facilities to store the quantities. I haven't seen anything like this since in the 1980s, when the Hunt brothers were building massive facilities in Texas just to store the bars of silver that they were buying. They needed to build an entire facility because they bought so much silver, they couldn't put it in their banks anymore. They were overwhelming them. So I am beginning to see a growing trend of some very, very deep pocket money that is beginning to make physical acquisitions. And they're doing it like they used to do years ago with famous pieces of art. They're just putting them away in the vault, and it becomes one of the family's assets. And, you know, we see these periodically as some of these collections come up for sale. It's like, wow, when did they do that? That's amazing.
So these 1% moves, you know, like today and back and forth, nothing really out of the ordinary there. Daily buying and selling, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, cool.
You could pretty much, if you ever want to look at gold and guess where it's going on any given day, take a look at the U.S. dollar index. If the dollar index is higher, probably you're going to see a dip in the price of gold that day by a couple bucks. And if the reverse is true, if the dollar has weakened across the board, chances are pretty good the price of gold is going to bounce up. And this is why I am so optimistic, if you will, although I know I may sound as if I'm, you know, putting out a kind of a negative, you know, sort of thought process about the future of the economy. I believe the economy will survive. This is a survivable environment. We will come through this as Americans. This will be a thing of the past in no time, and we'll be on to the next crisis in the years to come. And, you know, as we look at this moving forward, I think people will come to recognize that there was an interesting market environment here that, you know, we could have looked at it and understood a little bit better.
Okay, Freddie, we're going to, let me turn my phone down. Okay, kid, we're going to get on to another guest. Thanks for being here. USCoinCapital.com. It is 800-878-2646. Which is coin, right? If you forget, COIN.
That is.
Yeah, cool.
And, you know, we appreciate this opportunity, Patrick.
Oh, it's our pleasure.
Shows like yours. This is how a lot of the information gets disseminated to the average person. You know, you ask why more people don't involve themselves. I think shows like this really help people have an alternative bit of information to be able to add into the mix of what's going on. So, again, this is a hard subject for the media because we can get into all the control of that. But in the end, I think, you know, these kinds of programs where you have the ability to have these kinds of free conversations are critical in the current world.
I believe so. That's why we do it, brother. Okay, thanks a lot. Have a good one. See you soon.
Be well. Be healthy.
Take care. If you'd like to call Fred, it is 800-878-2646. 800-878-2646, U.S. Coin Capital. It's the place to go. Okay, we're going to do a quick little break here, and then we're going to talk about the Revolutionary War and see if it was just the people who lived in America were revolting because they didn't take a shower, or they really had a bone to pick with King George, because it's coming up July 4th this weekend, right? We're going to have fun talking to Jack Remington Grand. Graham, we're going to take a little break. Stay right there.
We are listener-supported, One Radio Network.